The UN says that humanity stands on the brink of catastrophic man-made climate change. But is it true?
Not a chance. But we do stand on the brink of catastrophic government policies that threaten to ruin the nation our forefathers built and defended against tyranny.
So what drives the climate scare, Jay?
Besides simple ignorance, the scare is driven by corporate greed and the desire of government to control all aspects of our lives, Tom.
Is this part of something more sinister?
Indeed it is. Whether it's climate change or a pandemic or socialism, it really means sacrificing your rights and accepting the tyranny of the fourth branch of government, the bureaucracy. It must be stopped.
This is The Other Side of the Story with Dr. Jay Lair and Tom Harris of the International Climate Science Coalition.
Hey, Jay, I understand that you have a good connection with agriculture yourself.
I certainly do, Tom. It's probably 40 years ago when I was giving an academic lecture in Indianapolis that a fellow who had a speaker's bureau in agriculture heard me speak and asked if I would like to be part of his speaker's bureau. And I said I would. And really, for the next 25 years, I would say more than half of the talks hundreds of talks I've given around the country are to agriculture groups. And along the way, I studied every aspect of agriculture and became quite expert at it. But what I learned mostly is that farmers, you know, are just the best people in the world. Farm kids are the best children I've run into across the country. And so I just developed a tremendous respect for everybody involved in modern agriculture. And it really started to bother me when the left started to attack the very best people we have in the United States that provide us with the healthiest and most economic food. It's just been amazing what's happening. And in recent years, the woke generation and all the terrible things we're putting up with, and now more than ever, this dreadful administration that has taken power is running roughshod over the American farmer and agriculture. So, Yes, I certainly do have a connection.
Yeah. Well, you know, I get the impression that most city dwellers have no clue that the best environmentalists and stewards of our land are, in fact, the farmers. I mean, people just don't know that. I mean, when you tell that to crowds, you must find that makes sense. Of course, that would be the case. What do you find?
It's exactly the case. They are the very best environmental stewards of our land. And it's just unbelievable that the left is trying to turn it upside down and say they use too much water, they use too much pesticides, that our food isn't healthy and we should grow organically, and they use too much energy. It's absolutely amazing the lies they tell. And unfortunately, some of them are taking hold. There are people that do not understand what you just said, that farmers are the best stewards of the land and the best environmentalists we have.
Yeah. It's so much like 1984, the book, hey, like the Ministry of Peace is really the Ministry of War. And of course, they say environmentalists, you know, care about our farmers, but then they do these stupid things like the Waters of the U.S., which basically hurt the farmers. Can you say a little bit about this Waters of the U.S. thing? I don't know if very many people understand what that is.
Well, it's a law put in place by Mr. Obama to essentially a land grab to take charge of more and more of our land by saying, the way I like to put it is, if you've got a puddle on your land that the Army Corps of Engineers says might one day fill up and overflow into a stream, a creek, or a river that would run into a navigable waterway, the Army Corps of Engineers and EPA get to take charge of that land to the extent you can't do anything with that land without getting permission from both EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers. It is one of the most egregious restrictions ever placed on farmland and really everybody's land. Mr. Trump, early on in his presidency, overruled and undid it. And of course, now with Mr. Biden in power, they undoubtedly will put it back in place to the negative impact of all our farmers. It won't last long because they're going to lose their power in the midterm elections and surely in the election of 2024. So it will be another inconvenience for a few years, but it's crazy.
Yeah. Well, I really encourage people to go to the epa.gov website, epa.gov, and give their input, because the idea that a farmer can't drain a swamp or, you know, do the things with his land that he wants, I mean, it's just crazy. You know, Jay, we're happy to have today a guest, agriculture broadcaster, journalist, and rancher, Trent Luz. And Trent travels the country teaching people the wonderful truths about agriculture to combat the lies of the left. You know, Jay, Trent recently completed a 100-day journey across the U.S. lecturing city folks about agriculture, and he was met by large crowds happy to learn exactly what you just said, that farmers are the best environmentalists and stewards of our land. And Mr. Luz explains how very sustainable American agriculture really is. So welcome to the show, Trent.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be with you and always great to be hanging with Jay, although it'd be nice if we were in the same location instead of three different continents, practically.
Yeah, exactly.
Trent, I wanted to ask you how you were able to arrange lectures in cities across the country for 100 days and get the city folks to come and listen to you, and what the reaction was to what you taught them about agriculture.
I'm glad you asked me that, Jay, because it's exactly what I've always wanted to do. I didn't know how to do it, and I didn't even come up with the idea. The late Robert David Steele came up with the idea. He had the idea that we should go to all 50 states. We should talk about freedom. We should talk about faith, family, and freedom to be all-inclusive. And I was the agricultural person on this 5-bus touring bus tour, and ended up, because I know somebody in every single county in this great nation, he said to me, he said, well, Trent, you want to just take over putting together these events? And I said, well, if you don't have a plan, we'll find one. And so I was actually the one who secured each location. We did not make it 100 days. We went 70 days. In 70 days, We had events in 37 states, 57 different events. And Jay, you'll relate to this as much as anything, because you and I have been a part of meetings where people, some entity, a group, an agricultural group or any civics group will call and they want to have a meeting and they want to plan for 3 to 5 months and get the marketing out there. You can't believe this, but on 57 events, my average lead time in securing a venue, a location, and who was going to be the local coordinator was 5 days. I pulled some of them off within 2 days. There was a couple that I didn't like the location that we had, and we switched and we did it the day before. And we still averaged over 300 people in 37 states, 57 different events. Our last event was Beaver, Pennsylvania. We had 1,400 people that were present in City Park in Beaver, Pennsylvania. We had a couple of local volunteers that were absolutely fantastic that got the crowds there. And that was the answer to your question in a short version. That's the way we did it. That's the way I did it, is I contacted people that I knew in a local area. They became the champion. They put the word of mouth out. We used websites, and people wanted to come and know, what do we need to do to take this country back?
Yeah.
That is really astounding. Trent, amazing to me, and you and I have been on many programs together over the years, and your ability to know key people in counties across the country who are able to put the word out and draw those people in is really outstanding. Going back even a little further, how did you, as a farmer rancher in America, having spoken on behalf of agriculture to more groups than anyone I know, how did you get started as an ambassador for agriculture while, you know, still working in agriculture, running a ranch?
Okay, so the first thing you need to know in that question is I married well. And so I have spent the last 21 years speaking on four continents and in 48 states. Like, actually, I've spoken in 41 states just since May 1st of this year. And I'm going to address a couple of things that you talked about before I joined the conversation. We have people sitting in cubicles designing marketing plans for restaurants and wholesale and retail locations, talking about we're going to achieve farmer sustainability by 2030. My family immigrated from Germany to Quincy, Illinois, Adams County, Illinois, in 1832. My family still farms the same land that the first loose came to from Germany in 1832. I left Illinois in 1988. My wife and I ranch in central Nebraska, but my sister, her husband, and my mother still reside at the home farm. And if that's not sustainable, then I don't know what sustainability is. If you take care of the same land since 1832.
I so agree. I would say I've certainly given 100 lectures to farm groups across the country and every state over the last 30 years. And there is never a lecture that I don't talk about sustainability. And that is one of the absolutely criminal complaints that the left has, that our food, our agriculture is not sustainable. You said it in those words. If it isn't sustainable, what is? And I think there is no other lesson that I'd like our listeners to learn today, is that don't ever sit still when you hear any of your friends and colleagues question the sustainability of our nation's agriculture. Nothing could be truer than we are sustainable and will continue to be so on into the future. Our biggest enemy is the government placing restrictions on us and the left telling lies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, of course, what Trent's talking about is applied sustainability in the real world, in contrast to these cubicle people.
And the only way you achieve that is to continue to focus on soil health, whether you're in animal agriculture, if you're in crop agriculture, vegetables, it doesn't matter. It comes back to soil health. We have everybody in the world now talking about, we want farmers to be carbon sequester carbon. Folks, we've been sequestering carbon since we started taking care of the soil, and we do a better job of it now than we ever did before, because it's all about soil health. If you don't have organic matter in your topsoil, you're going to be disappointed in your crops, yield after yield after yield. And this year, I've got friends that are at 335 bushel an acre corn. You don't accomplish that unless you have proper soil health. And that's what it comes back to: sustainability through improved soil health.
All right, so you name what you would see as the number one problem beyond soil health in terms of advancing agriculture. What do you see as the next three problems that agriculture faced in order of priority?
Well, I'm going to put one ahead of something that I've spent most of my time talking about in 2020 or 2021, and that is what you already brought up. The land grab, not only through WOTUS, that's the abbreviated Waters of the U.S., because previously, if you don't know, the federal government, everything that Jay said is absolutely spot on. The precedent behind that is that it previously stated that all navigable waters were under the control of the federal government, and they want to move that to where every puddle in your driveway is now under control of the federal government. That's a challenge. The 30 by 30, which I assume we will get to and talk about, that's on the top of my list. But the number one on my list is something that's been growing. And in my particular home state, which I love ranching in Nebraska, we have a wonderful climate. We have a wonderful political climate as well as an environmental climate. The first $140 for each calf I raise this year goes to pay property tax. Every year, the state average for property tax is $103 statewide. And I'm just using the cow-calf example. If you're raising corn or soybeans or wheat or potatoes in the valleys around Columbus, Nebraska, you have to pay the highest level of property tax of any farm state in this country. And so we're trying to fix that because you cannot achieve sustainability if you're paying more tax. Just think about this for a minute. $140 per calf per year. I am paying what I paid for my property every 12 years. What I paid to buy this ranch when Kelly and I bought this ranch 12 years ago, we've already paid the same amount of property tax that we paid to own the land in 12 years.
Wow.
How do you achieve sustainability? So what I did in that regard was, we have a fantastic governor, and I work with Governor Ricketts almost every week on the issues that really affect us at home. And after spending five consecutive years in the state capitol in Lincoln of fighting and trying to get property tax reform, I recognized what we preached every single stop on the Arise USA tour, Faith, Family, and Freedom. You need to control your home at your local level. And the property tax issue is happens in the county commissioner's office. It happens in the local school board. You need to engage at those local levels because that's where the spending, you know, it doesn't really matter what Biden does from an income tax structure. If my local property tax is so high that I never make any money, what difference does it make if there's a 70% income tax structure? So you have to control.
You've added a level to sustainability that many of our listeners may not understand. Agriculture can only be sustainable if they can make a profit growing their grain or raising their hogs and their cattle. If everything doesn't come together with a positive profit at the end of the year, then our sustainability really is in jeopardy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, spot on.
Yeah, it's amazing that farmers actually can make any money at all when you talk about taxes like that. I mean, are we seeing a movement away from individually owned farms?
Tom, even though the statistics say 97% of all farms in the United States are family owned, which is a true story, mm-hmm. the consolidation within those families has been phenomenal. And it would be pretty easy to say that generation after generation, farmers have not been profitable. They found a way to pay their bills and acquire the wealth. And when I say wealth, I'm not talking about becoming rich. I'm talking about acquiring wealth to pass to the next generation, which Jay spoke about earlier, in the value of the land. Now, what's happened is that you have Biden seeing that as an avenue. And there are people that cannot afford to grant their kids that they've spent generations, possibly four or five generations, building a farming or ranching operation. They can't afford to give it to their kids through an inheritance because the inheritance tax will cost more than the place is worth.
Oh, geez, that's terrible. So what happens to farms like that?
They sell them. They sell them to their neighbors, or they sell them to Bill Gates, who has gotten a lot of attention in the past year for being one of the largest farmland owners in the country. He's actually 51st on the list. Ted Turner is the second largest landowner. He is up. I don't need to tell anybody who that is. John McGlone is the number one landowner. He's a telecommunications guy based out of Denver, Colorado. And so what happens is that these farms and ranches go into wealthy individuals, into the haves and the have nots. And from a consumer standpoint, this all matters because we're seeing it now. We're seeing restrictions in our supply chain. We were seeing restrictions in access to food. And when we have this accelerated consolidation in the food business, the consumer better know who their farmer is and where their food is being grown, because they may not be able to just go to the grocery store and pick up what they wanted to every week like they have in the past.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's an overall trend where you're seeing these individual farms getting gobbled up.
Absolutely.
Mm. Wow, that's too bad.
Trent, you have your own radio show. Who does it reach, and what is its goal?
Loose Tales is my flagship. Loose Tales airs in 21 states on 100 radio stations, roughly 3 million listeners. So that's the broad section of all people. I do four radio shows every day The other shows are more geared towards the rural areas and very much farmer to farmer kind of a discussion, although we don't talk, I don't talk about farming techniques. I talk about better communication, understanding these issues, because, you know, we in the farm country, we like to point to people in Chicago as the problem. It's those city people in Ottawa, or those city people in Calgary, or the city people in New York City, they're the problem. Well, we have a serious disconnect within our own families. And so we spend a lot of time talking about how to address some of these issues that we're talking about here within our own families. You know, you brought up something that, Jay, you know, is the biggest buzzword and has been in agriculture in the last 20 years. And that is it organic? Is it organic food production? Well, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean it's better. Mm-hmm. We need to have an understanding of what that really means.
No. Yeah, the whole organic thing is full of misconceptions as well. I think it's really not as popular today as it was a couple of years ago when everybody was trading on the whole concept of organic. But I think your audiences, when I traveled around talking to farm groups, I have had a slogan or an idea that has really resonated with the farmers, understanding that there are only 2 million people working in agriculture when 1900, half the country was in an agriculture, which means we don't get the word out well enough. And I have convinced audience after audience, they owe 2 hours a month to tell their story somehow, whether it's writing newspapers or radio stations, talking at their dinner table, talking at parties and athletic events. I think the average person in agriculture, in all areas of agriculture, 2 million of them, could accomplish a great deal of your goals if they would all participate.
Yeah, and I love the numbers, the time frame that you put into place there, because in 1900, it required 10 acres of land to produce enough food to feed one person for a year. In 2021, it takes less than a third of an acre to produce enough food to feed one person for a year. And wow. So ultimately, Jay, I taken what you just said, and I've challenged ourselves a bit in that. And I don't want to tell people the story of agriculture anymore. I want to tell them the consumer story. I want to tell you what's at risk if these overbearing regulations continue to be put into play. You, the consumer, the farmer's going to have food to feed their own families. Where are you going to get your food? It's the consumer story, and particularly those low-income individuals that continue to be challenged in accessing high-quality, healthy food. That's the story that we need to tell and unite the food producer with the people who are challenged in accessing proper nutrition, which, by the way, I just want to point out quickly, that to me is the silver lining in this pandemic that we're dealing with right now. Is that people have finally stopped, taken a moment, and looked at their food and what the nutritional availability is of their food. For example, a lot of people have been trying to beat up milk, meat, and eggs, any animal products. If you take really take a look at the nutritional analysis of the meat products that we have accessible to us as consumers today, zinc has become one of the golden boys of nutrition and building your immune system to fight off not only COVID, but all disease challenges. And guess what? Meat from animals is absolutely the highest level of available zinc, and beef is number one on that list. So people are beginning to ask different questions about their food in terms of nutritional availability, which I think long-term is the silver lining that we really needed to have something to come along out of this mess that we currently have, which is all government-driven.
Since you mentioned beef, I rail against fake meat. I think I'm beginning to see fake meat companies do very poorly economically. And do you ever talk about it? Do you have any comments about meat that is not meat?
In fact, Jason Lusk, head of Department of Economics, Ag Economics at Purdue University, just last week posted a graph of the past 12 months in the consumption of all meat proteins, including the alternative protein. Turkey, year to date, this is the date of October 31st, so it would have been Halloween 30 days ago now. Turkey was off the charts in terms of what it has been in terms of consumption and purchases, why turkey is always a very reasonably priced protein, meat protein source. Beef, pork, and chicken have been steady for 12 months. Consumers are buying the same amount of beef and consuming the same amount of beef. The real growth has been in turkey. Alternative meat substitutes are 7% lower year from this week than they were a year ago. That's despite all of the nonsense that the media continues to tell you that everybody's going to alternative meats because of this and because of that. Number one, they're not healthy for you. Number two, they're too intensive. And number three, they cost too much. Number four, you have something that God created that gives you the nutrient density that you need. Oh, and by the way, meat not only tastes good and provides nutrition for you, the animal serves a purpose in keeping a healthy planet. And without the animal, you're not going to have a healthy planet. CO2 feeds plants. Plants feed animals. Animals feed people. It's called the cycle of life. You cannot disrupt the cycle of life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. You know, I had a quick question, and that is, when you actually look at the CO2 absorbed by your crops, is that actually more than the land was before the crops were grown?
Absolutely, it is. It's actually quite significant. In fact, I have some Michigan State numbers here. I just refreshed them today because last week they did some new, posted some new numbers. 1 acre of corn, U.S. corn crop, number two yellow corn, mm-hmm. will consume 36,000 pounds of CO2 in a growing season.
Mm-hmm. Let me jump in right there and remind all of our listeners that CO2 is not a pollutant. It is the molecule of life. We only live here on this planet because we have an adequate amount of CO2 to create the plants you talk about and allow the animals to live. So anytime the debate or subject of who makes the CO2 and who absorbs it should not be important because the plants need 150 parts per million to survive. 280 was desperately low. And fortunately, the economic revolution led us to about 420 parts per million. And we'd be better off yet if that would double fairly soon to 800 parts per million. So anytime you talk about CO2, I think it's important to throw in the fact that the wonders of CO2 really create this blue planet. But I want to throw in a little anecdote about meat eating and how important it is. Not too long ago, I gave a lecture to the National Cattlemen's Association in Denver. And before the lecture, I went to the best steakhouse in Denver to see how things were going. And I counted the chairs. It was a Wednesday night. I was speaking Thursday morning. I counted how many chairs there were in the restaurant. There were 450 of them. And everyone was full eating mostly steak. So our desire to eat real meat is not declining at all.
Well, that's a good place for us to take a break for now. We'll be right back.
Dr. Peter McCullough, if you go to healthycell.com, you can check out the technology, the products of Healthy Cell. These are very innovative products. They are a form of bio-nutraceuticals that are bioactive, and they come in a variety of categories. One is daily essentials, which are the bioactive multi and the vegan essentials. And then the next category is performance. And this is the REM sleep supplement. I've talked about it a lot. I think it's very effective and I recommend it for myself and for my family, but as well as my patients. I'm having great luck with this because it is such a terrific product with a blend of, I think, is what's needed for not only promoting sleep, but also getting quality sleep. And when gets quality sleep, then there's restfulness, and the next day is better, and then the next night is better, and it becomes a progressively positive cycle for the human body. And the next product in the performance category is Focus and Recall. Focus and Recall. And I think that is the featured product that is coming into play for those with long COVID and brain fog that develops after COVID-19, the respiratory infection, but also after COVID-19 vaccination. And then finally, the main horse in Healthy Cell is the targeted support of immune superboost. And what we have here is a series of products that really can toe the line for patients who are working their way through the COVID-19 pandemic, either at risk for COVID-19, have had COVID-19 and recovered, are in the post-COVID syndrome, which is now a diagnosis we put in the electronic medical record, and are suffering through a variety of manifestations of post-COVID syndrome. And then lastly, those who are in the throes of vaccine reactions of some sort, whether they be acute serious vaccine reactions or the more common mild prolonged vaccine reactions. We now know the spike protein lasts in the human body after the respiratory infection or after vaccination for up to 15 months. We had this breaking development brought to you on America Out Loud Talk Radio with Dr. Bruce Patterson on a recent episode. So we know this is the case. And so we know if the Wuhan spike protein is in the human body for up to 15 months, it's going to cause damage. It's going to cause inflammation. It's going to set a whole variety of immune responses up, working against our body and potentially damaging cells, tissues, intercellular communication systems, and very importantly, influencing organ function. And here is where we need the maximum defense for the body, the maximum and the most appropriate blend of micronutrients, minerals, as well as vitamins to help the body get through this difficult time. So go to healthycell.com and check out the products. And in the promotional code, use the term out loud for 20% off your first purchase. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Trent, you're not just a speaker, and really you're just a major force in agriculture across the country. But back home, you have a ranch operation, and I'm sure our listeners would like to know a little more about it because your feet are on the ground, your hands are in the earth. Describe your own operation and who runs it when you're on the road so much of the year.
Same person that runs it when I'm home, Jay. What I learned pretty quickly that if you spend half of your nights in a hotel room somewhere talking about what's happening in agriculture and your wife is home managing the operation, when you get home, you don't start telling her what to do. You say, "What do you need me to do today, honey?" That's how that works. So in my lifetime, I'm 55 years old, born in 1966. And in my lifetime, I actually did this calculation because I got really fed up with people who were trying to tell me what animal welfare was really about. And I have personally cared for 1 million animals in my lifetime. And that is provided daily care, whatever it's needed to minimize the stress of the animal, because that's the job of the farmer, the rancher, the stockman. You know, I want to get back to that term because really what we need to be are stockmen. Looking at it, people say, "Oh, the animal can't speak. We have to speak for them." That's because you don't understand the animal. There is not a horse. There's not a cow. There's not a pig on this place that every day when I look at them, I look at how they're holding their head. I look at how they're holding their eye. I know exactly what's going on with them. And that comes from generation after generation of being taught by father and grandfather, because I grew up in the ideal environment in my world. I grew up with a father and a grandfather who farmed together in partnership. And I was that kid that was along, always doing the work alongside dad and grandpa. And I fortunately met a woman from Nebraska. We live 14 miles from her parents, who are 81 years old, who grew up in just nearly identical scenario and lifestyle that I did. She understands the need to get out and tell the story, and her contribution to get out and explain the importance of agriculture, food, fiber, pharmaceuticals, and fuel is she's home every day taking care of what needs to be done here. We're very blessed with three girls, 23, 19, and 16. And they carry that same work ethic and determination that their mother has. Today on our operation, Central Nebraska, we have pared back quite a bit because we don't hire anybody. She takes care of everything, and I'm here to help. We have 100 sows. We funnel the pork from that sow operation into a niche program where we're selling direct to the consumer. We have a 100 beef cow operation were part of a genetic selection on seed stock side on a certified Piedmontese, which is a niche beef operation that does really specializes in the myostatin gene. And we have 20 horses in our operation, but I want to talk a moment about something that I think, if you're not familiar with agriculture, it's an advantage and a technology that we're utilizing that really tells us what's going on. Everybody and their dog, literally everybody and their dog, wants to know what their ancestry is. They want to take the genomic test. They want to know, are they part Scottish, or my goodness, are they a little Norwegian in there, or is my dog a Yorkshire Terrier? What is it? You know, what's going on with that? Every single breeding animal that we use on this place, whether it be a pig or a bull, we do a genomics test, and we look at qualities, genetic qualities and markers that are there for such things as calving ease, as growth rate, as feed efficiency. And the one that we really pay attention to is eating quality. And the Piedmontese cattle possess two copies of the myostatin gene, which the myostatin gene is responsible for tenderness. But when there's two copies there and it's a mutant copy, there's no regulation on muscle growth. And what that means is that the muscle in these cattle grow at an unregulated rate. And lo and behold, thanks to the research from Meat Animal Research Center, we know that that's the most tender beef you can possibly eat. So that's part of the supply chain that we're working on from a genetic standpoint. And then we use those same genomic marker evaluations on all of our breeding stock in the pig business, because we want an animal that is very efficient, very stress-free to raise, but we want, at the end of the day, we want to generate the highest eating quality possible. So even though we're a very mid-sized operation, not big in any way, shape, or form, it's not small when it comes to doing chores, we really look at tailoring to the niche and produce exactly the best product we can with the science and technology that's available to us to get it done.
Well, you have just supported one of the comments I wanted to make clear to our listeners, and that is how advanced in sophistication and in technology in running today's farm and ranch. The average person thinks that today's farm is the same as the father's farm, the grandfather's farm, and going back in generations. Agriculture has kept up in technology as much as any industry I can think of. And you have just described that to a T. It is really amazing. If I thought more and more of the public understood how sophisticated and advanced we are technologically, we would be able to battle the lies of the left, I think, much, much better. Because today, the average person does not realize the advantages, and they're thinking about the farm as the farm might have been by your great-grandfather and your grandfather, but nothing like it today.
No, and sometimes, Jay, you just have to get lucky, and I just live lucky. 2 years ago, we identified through genomic testing that we had this boar that's a pig, male hog, that it was a son of a boar we called Harvest Moon. I named this boar Beaver Moon because I named him in the month of November, which is famous for the beaver. The full moon is called the Beaver Moon. Turns out that he is the greatest sire we've ever had. We have sold semen to people in 30 different states around the United States because they recognize his superior quality. And I had no idea that coming into November 2021, there would be a lunar eclipse of the full beaver moon that was the first time to happen in the United States for 380 years.
Oh, wow. Well, I know a little bit about your operation. I live about 2 miles from Select Sires, one of the biggest companies that send semen all over the world. I've spent a lot of time touring it, and you're doing it on your own. Which brings me back. I don't see how your wife can handle all of the cattle, the pigs, and the horses. She's got to have some help other than you when you're home.
No. You remember Wonder Woman? I married her.
Yeah. Actually, I've always thought I was married to Wonder Woman, but I guess my wife would certainly be in competition with yours, what she achieves. It's amazing.
She must work a 40-hour day.
Yeah, she does work too much. It's a serious stress level. The only thing that she won't do here, guys, is collect a boar, collect the semen from a boar. That's my job. The difference between my operation, just maybe in the weeds too much for people listening, but you mentioned Select Sires, which is, by the way, a co-op owned by farmers and ranchers all across this country in the beef and in the dairy side of the semen business. They send their semen and they handle their semen, process it as frozen semen, use liquid nitrogen to keep it way below, like 200 degrees below zero, and it will live indefinitely in that state. Our semen that we send around the country, we've developed it. We didn't do it. There is a technology that we adapt where we can take fresh semen, collect it today, put it in an overnight mailing container, keep it at 62 degrees, and we can ship that anywhere in the world, actually, as long as it can maintain that temperature. Now, if you ship semen to New Zealand or Australia, you will have to freeze it. But we send fresh semen, and guys, that semen will last up to 14 days to inseminate a sow somewhere. I send a lot of semen to the state of Washington, for example. It's amazing that I can have a boar in central Nebraska inseminating sows in the state of Washington simply because we've identified the genetics that want to be replicated.
That's pretty impressive. So there's offspring of your boar all over the world, really.
That is correct.
Huh. Now, are your children following in your footsteps or going in other directions?
So our oldest, 23, is a nutritionist in the medical system in south of Salt Lake City, basically. Our middle daughter is studying nursing at a college. She's a freshman. She's the one that probably has the greatest interest and is building her own cow herd. Our youngest, she's going to be a rocket scientist or whatever she wants to be. She also has her own cow herd as well. The interest is there. The oldest one is not. The other two are going to definitely be involved hands-on.
Yeah. Now, concerning the ethanol mandate, I mean, Jay and I oppose it. We think it's a complete waste for the public. How do you come down on the ethanol and the mandate?
I have never been a fan of anything that had the word mandate tied to it.
Yeah.
That just, I support ethanol. I support it. Two things I don't agree to: anything that has to do with a mandate or a subsidy. Okay. And so that eliminates a lot of things, but I'm 55 years old. I've been owning animals myself since I was 8, and I can tell you that I have never taken a dollar in a subsidy from the federal government. And I just think they're the ruination. Well, Calvin Coolidge nailed it in the 20s, but people wouldn't listen to him. They said, if you let the farmer take a subsidy, they'll continue to ruin agriculture and they'll never have a profit. It all comes back to where we started. You ask, Tom, is there ever a profit? Well, there won't be, because we have too many subsidies and too many government mandates that minimize the opportunity for farmers to make it work.
How do you tell our listeners that most of them think that the average farmer in America does get handouts from the government? And I often argue that, you know, we are so subject to the vagaries of weather that once in a while we need a hand up to protect the prices of our food at the grocery store. But I think the average American feels that the farmer gets more welfare than he should. You've just explained in your long career, you've managed without it. So how do you talk to a farm group about this subject?
That's an interesting question, because if I'm talking to a farm group that is primarily of crop production and they're not livestock people, they have taken subsidies. And you name the subsidy that's most common today. And that is if you're growing a crop and there is 1 minute of one day, a hailstorm comes and eliminates your crop without a crop insurance plan, which is subsidized by the government, you're not going to make it work. So most crop farmers have taken a farm subsidy simply through their crop protection program and their crop insurance. If you're talking to a livestock group, they're pretty much going to be the same mentality as me, because there's never been any subsidies built in for livestock production. Let me exclude dairy. Dairy has had its own marketing niches, and it is so complex. There have been, through the years, some subsidies in the dairy business, but by far and away today, it's crop production versus livestock production.
I'm hoping we can switch gears here a little bit to the anti-genetically modified grain GMO battle. In Canada, of course, we get a lot of our wheat crops specifically because we were able to basically have a GMO in modifying the gene so that it could grow in cold conditions. I mean, do you think this anti-genetically modified grain GMO battle, do you think it's run its course?
I think it doesn't matter if it's run its course or not, because I'm told by people who are in the know, let's just talk about glyphosate, because I don't think people actually care about GMO crops. They never liked Monsanto, and they tied Monsanto to glyphosate. So they're anti-glyphosate, even though Monsanto hasn't owned glyphosate for quite some time now. It's owned by Bayer Crop Science based out of Germany. So all glyphosate is mixed and manufactured in Germany. And I'm told by people who are in the know that they cannot get the components from China to put glyphosate together. So to answer your question in a short sentence, yeah, I think it might have run its course, because there is a serious supply chain issue with glyphosate that I'm told in 2022 could be up close and personal for a lot of people. But I just want to emphasize what I said, and I'd love to have Jay's take on this as well. People don't have a clue what a GMO is. They don't know that there's, until very recently, there was only 7 GMOs, and hardly any of those were, 2 actually, were consumed by humans. The others are consumed by animals. Mm-hmm. They don't know what a GMO actually is. They only know that Monsanto is evil. That's their perception. And that they own glyphosate. Consequently, it's got to be bad.
Well, I would disagree with you somewhat, Trent. The glyphosate issue, I think, is quite separate from people's concern that we are altering what people would think of as natural food by playing with their genes. For the first 10 years or so, most people felt that this was not a good idea, or let's say enough people felt that way. Other countries were able to stop our exporting genetically modified foods or grains, mostly not because they thought there was a problem. It gave them an edge in utilizing their own products and not having to buy ours. But that's pretty much dying all over the country. There's hardly a day, as I read the agricultural literature, I don't read about some country or other now admitting a genetically modified grain that was not allowed before. So the glyphosate issue, I think, is separate. And I think the anti-GMO is dying out. In my lectures, I explain the tremendous advantages of genetic modification. We have been studying weeds in the desert and trying to figure out how those weeds live in high heat and low moisture. And when we find the genes that allow that to happen, and we can move those genes into a grain crop, we actually can grow more food in areas that were not before considered favorable to agriculture. So we've made tremendous strides. And as I watch the literature and the news around the world, I think the anti-GMO folks are about finished, and we're moving forward. Again, the glyphosate situation, just as you said, was anti-Monsanto as much as everything else. The battle still goes on, and there will always be a cadre of lawyers trying to get people to sue other people based on misconceptions and lies. So that'll probably continue to go on for a while.
I think it's a great discussion, Jay, whether you and I agree on every aspect of it. The one thing that we will agree on, which brings a hypocritical nature of this entire discussion, is the same people who are prone to be anti-GMO will be the first people to seek alternative meat substances grown in a lab that are not possible to be grown in a lab without a GMO.
You know, I am so thrilled you said that, because I have to admit, Trent, I never thought of that. You are absolutely right. They are the same people. And I've never thought about using that example in my writing and my lectures, but I will in the future.
Mm-hmm. So the whole concept of Frankenfoods, we hear that. It sounds like that's just nonsense.
It is nonsense. I mean, mm-hmm. there's not, throughout the course of history, there's not one single person that has any documented harm from the consumption of genetically modified organism. I am a genetically modified organism. All that has been done through science is speed up through the generational process, the advancements and selection of certain traits that we want to adopt and put into our production systems. It really goes back to Vietnam. It's interesting that you and I are having this discussion on this day that the Vietnam draft first began in 1969, because during the Vietnam War, people learned that they could protest and make money, and they would just arbitrarily send them money. The war ended for those folks, and so they had to continue to find new causes, and the anti-GMO crowd found, like the animal rights people, they just sell emotions and pretend to be part of the solution when in fact they perpetuate the problem. This is their cash cow. It's how they sell fear so that you will send them money.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. Earlier on, you were saying how the farmer wants to have low stress in their animals. And it strikes me that of all people, the farmers would be treating their animals better than anybody. I mean, surely that's an argument against some of these activist groups.
Look, the system was designed by God that if there is stress in an animal's life or a plant's life, this is no different between plants and animals. But if there's some stress in the environment, the first thing that fails is reproduction. Mm-hmm. And that's a natural instinct, because the instinct is, oh, there's some stress in the environment. We don't want to produce more because there will continue to increase the stress. So if I, as a farm owner, an animal owner, do not do everything possible to minimize the stress of the animal, their natural instinct is to produce less. If I keep this animal in the closest thing to a stress-free life, and there is no stress-free life, there's no utopia. My job is to minimize them from the greatest stressor. And the greatest stressor for all animals is not people, it's other animals and the weather. And so mm-hmm. what can I do to protect? You ever seen the wild horses in the West? They are the most ruthless to one another you could ever imagine. One day I'm at Lovelock, Nevada, in an allotment that's 2 million acres, and we come up on a stud that's got a broken leg. It's laying in the Nevada hot desert sun. And how did it break its leg? Well, it's just what studs do. They fight to see who the dominant stud is, and that's who's going to be there and who's going to be laying there in the desert to die a miserable death. Animals need protection from the environment, and they need protection from each other. My job as a stockman is to give them the protection that they need to lead the lowest stress life possible.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I wish the activists heard that. Well, we'll make sure we spread this interview around. That's for sure.
Therein lies the problem. The activists don't want to hear the solution, because if they actually, the solution is presented to the public, they lose their ability to fundraise. Their job is fundraising. It's not to take care of animals. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. No question about that. I'm lecturing on that my whole life, that any organization that doesn't want animals raised in agriculture and people for the ethical treatment of animals have actually no clue. And you have made the statement that I've probably said 1,000 times, that no living thing operates optimally under stress. We go to work. If we're under stress, we don't accomplish as much that day. Every plant under stress does not work as well. Stress is a negative. You described it well. And I think that's a message to take away, that when we are raising animals on a ranch or any operation, it is in our best interest for those animals to be as stress-free. Before we end, I'd like to turn the discussion a little bit to politics. And I wonder, as you are going around lecturing, if you talk much about politics, I would assume an agricultural audience is far more conservative than liberal, though I no longer know how it would break up percentage wise. What would you speak to on that issue?
So if you think that anything, including food production, doesn't have politics attached, then you simply just aren't thinking. And I've had more criticism in the last 3 months from my radio listeners saying, Trent, I started listening to you because you talked about agriculture. Now all you talk about is politics. Well, politics and the political movements that we see taking place are putting your food production and your energy production in jeopardy. And so if you're not talking about politics, you're not talking about the great challenges that we have in front of us. I mentioned briefly, and I just want to explain 30 by 30, which was part of the executive order Biden issued on January the 27th this year, which is also comes out of the United Nations. This is not just happening in the United States. It's a United Nations directive that he signed on to, and it's called 30 by 30, which says 30% of the U.S. landmass and oceans should be under conservation easements and management of the government by 2030. Well, while on the surface, that sounds like, well, that sounds like a good thing. Conservation is a good thing, right? Well, the best conservation is for the people who own the land and do what is conservation is about, which is produce more with less, using fewer resources to produce more outcome. Now, let's quickly look at the whole picture here, because it's not 30 by 30. Currently, the United States landmass, one in every 3 acres is owned by the federal government. Currently, we have 12% of the United States landmass already in a conservation easement. A conservation easement says you sign up with somebody issuing a conservation easement saying, I'm going to give up my development rights. I'm going to give up whatever right it may be, but I have to get permission from you to do anything I want to do on my property, even though I own it. I signed a conservation easement with you. So 12% is already there. So if you take the 33% that currently owned by the federal government plus the 12% that's already in a conservation easement, you have 45% of the United States landmass already under some control of the federal government. Biden wants to add 30% to that, which means 3 in every 4 acres in the United States would be controlled by the federal government. If that doesn't make your hair on the back of your neck stand up and say, wait a minute, I don't want the federal government controlling the land where my food and energy is going to come from, then you need to get active now.
Mm-hmm. So you can't divorce the politics and the agriculture from each other.
You cannot.
Now, I don't worry about all these statements he makes every day, making this administration clearly desiring to destroy the country as it was set up by our founding fathers, because I'm convinced that every morning a few thousand more Americans wake up realizing what a mistake it was to vote in a way to put the Biden administration in power and run the House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate. I'm quite convinced that in November of 2022, will take back the House in a landslide and the Senate in a smaller majority. And he's not going to be able to do the things that he talks about on a daily basis. How active a conservative House and Senate will be in undoing some of the damage he's already done is a question I can't answer. I'm also very confident in 2024 that the Republicans will win the presidency and hopefully will have a president that can undo things the way that Trump did in his 4 years. It wasn't enough, but I believe that November 2022 will be the beginning of taking back our country.
Well, that was an excellent interview, Trent, and we really enjoyed it. And we'll spread this around and actually help educate a lot more city folks like you do about the real wonderful truths of agriculture. So this is Tom Harris and Jay Lear with our guest, Trent Lewes, signing out from the other side of the story.